Welcome, and thanks for listening to Intrinsic Investigations. My name is Mr. Olivo, and I created this podcast because I've been fortunate enough over the last decade to see unique and thought-provoking projects happen in my classroom, and we wanted a place to showcase them. The true heart of this podcast lies not in the content discovered, but in exploring the personal stories of these young researchers as they journey through uncharted and unfamiliar intellectual terrain. By sharing their stories, we hope to normalize the challenges and frustrations that come with independent research, and also share those moments where students transcend the normal grind of the school day to discover concepts that range from the global to deeply personal. We will begin with a brief introduction to the student of focus, why they pick their topic, and discuss their growth over the course of the last year. It should be mentioned that the opinions expressed in this podcast in no way reflect the opinions of our school district, Bergen County Technical Schools and Special Services, or our school itself, Bergen County Technical High School Teterboro, or the College Board. The work detailed in this podcast was most likely completed in AP Capstone, but this podcast is in no way affiliated with the College Board. This season has many examples of multiple interviewees, and this session is no different. We have Jenna and Sarah, and today's topic is all about rhetoric. So understanding how language is used to persuade or inform audiences. And the subject of our rhetorical analysis with the two of you is the current president, Donald Trump. Before we get into the nature of your work, Jenna, why don't you introduce yourself, and then Sarah, you'll introduce yourself. Just tell us a little something about, I don't know, what you like to do. Give a little mini biography. Go right ahead.
Hi, guys. I'm Jenna. I'm a junior in fashion. I like to sew. I volunteer SAT tutor on the weekends sometimes. I'm kind of just here. I'm doing my thing.
Here and doing your thing. All right.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm also a junior in fashion, and I chose this topic about Donald Trump because I think the political route is somewhere that I want to go in the future, and I think that my research really helped me pave my path, so I hope you like our podcast.
All right, so political science in the future. Mm-hmm. Jenna, what do you think?
I want to do fashion in the future, I want to do fashion in the future, but I think this is a really great experience to learn more about politics, especially we're getting towards being voting age. I kind of want to have, as I grow up, I want to have a better understanding of politics and how our government is run.
Valid point. That's right. Neither of you have ever voted.
Nope.
Do either of you remember an Obama presidency?
Barely. I would say, I don't think I was really interested in politics when I was, 10 years old, but...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I remember my dad actually took me with him into, the voting booth for the Trump-Clinton election. I was, 8. I don't know if that's legal. Don't, clip that.
So 2016 yeah. was the first time you were exposed to the democratic process. What? Directly.
Yeah. I remember there was, this boy in my second grade class, and he'd be like, did you hear what Trump said last night? And that was kind of, a moment for me where I was like, oh.
All right, yeah, so first grade, you weren't really aware. Maybe kindergarten. I would assume that I was not aware of those things either. So Donald Trump has been, I guess, he's been a pretty apparent political force for you as you've become more cognizant of politics. Is that a factor? We'll start with you, Jenna. Is that a factor in why you elected... no pun intended here, to investigate his rhetoric in debates? Is that something that was a factor in this decision-making process?
Definitely. I've been hearing all about Trump's rhetoric for, years. I had a seventh grade social studies teacher who was really into making us watch debates.
Okay.
I actually got really into, the SNL versions of the debates, which is part of the reason why I wanted to do this. The other reason why I wanted to do this topic is this year I was listening in on the 2024 debate, and I ended up hearing the line, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats. And what kind of went through my head was, why was this said? What is the motivation? What was the effect of this? And it kind of steered me towards the direction I ended up taking.
And that was, correct me if I'm wrong, an October debate.
Yes.
And by November is when proposals need to start for this class. So you had that eureka moment, and then a month later you had a full-on proposal that included not just the debates that happened in this election cycle, but the previous one as well.
Yeah.
All right. So Sarah, what about you? What was the inspiration here for... It's not just Donald Trump's rhetoric in your work, too. So mm-hmm. I think that We'll get to that, to the specifics a little bit more. But what did you see here?
Okay, so to be completely honest, I think that in the beginning of my research process, I was really stuck on what topic to choose. And I think I like kind of sometimes forget that because I feel like my topic right now is really smooth running. But in the beginning, I was really stuck on what topic I wanted to do. I actually kind of like balanced between like developmentally disabled adults to like AI-generated art and like the manosphere, actually. And I felt like the more I like forced myself to kind of pick a topic, it was harder to like actually come to one. And I think when I actually came to my topic about Donald Trump, it came more smoothly. Actually, I made a goal to myself that I would read like a New York Times article every single day before I sleep. And that was kind of to increase like my cognitive ability and like my attention span for my SAT. Because we have to read a lot of like reading passages.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And I think one of those articles actually had something about Donald Trump. And it was actually pointing out one of his statements that he made towards Nancy Pelosi, where he called her basically by the B word. And that kind of like really like was shocking to me because I didn't know that in like formal politics, like that's something that you can say. And that actually like was in a rally. So that kind of opened my eyes to like the setting of my research and like who I wanted to focus on. And I think that from there, it was just like, you know.
And the two of you are looking at political speech in very different contexts. Jenna, you're looking at it in debates solely, and Sarah, you're looking at it in rallies. So the way that public figures are going to talk, you would think, is going to be different in those environments, whether they're Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever. Okay. Before we get into the nature of your work, we're going to because you have been focusing a lot on rhetoric, we're going to play a little game that I'm going to give you quotes, and you're going to have to, they're either from Joe Biden or Donald Trump, and you're going to have to guess who you think said it. Please don't let the other person influence your answer. I'm going to ask if your minds are made up, and people at home can play along if they want to as well, or people in the classroom too. I see a couple people looking around right now. All right, here's the first one. How confident do you feel in this?
Oh, I mean, earlier yesterday you said that like some of the statements are like can be mistaken for each one. So
yeah,
I
think
scared.
There's only maybe a few, I think, but we'll see here. Okay. All right, here we go. Here's the first one. I'll paraphrase the phrase of my old neighborhood. The rest of the country's the world is not a patch in our jeans. If we do what we want to do, we need to do.
Can you say that again?
I will say that one more time in case people were confused by what I said. I'm trying to say this as, like, I'm not trying to do an impression of Trump or Biden, which I've been known to do outside of class. All right, so here we go. I'll paraphrase the phrase of my old neighborhood, the rest of the country's, the world is not a patch in our jeans. If we do what we want to do, we need to do.
Mm, okay.
All right.
Sarah, I made up my mind.
You got your mind? All right, Jenna?
I have no idea, but I have a guess.
Okay. All right. Sarah?
I think Trump.
Okay. I think Biden.
Audience?
Biden.
Oh. This was actually a Joe Biden quote from 2023 in remarks about infrastructure spending. Okay. Ugh. All right. All right. It's okay. All right. All right. Here we go. We have a country that's in trouble. The country is in big, big trouble. We're a failing nation. We're a nation in decline.
Okay. Definitely Trump.
Definitely Trump.
Audience.
Trump.
All right. That was Trump. Okay. That was campaign statements. Okay. Here's another one. I guess what I'm trying to say without boring you too long at breakfast, and you all look dull as hell, I might add. The dullest audience I have ever spoken to. Just sitting there staring at me. Pretend you like me.
This has to be Trump too.
That sounds like something Trump would say.
This is actually a Joe Biden
really?
Quote while teasing donors at a fundraiser breakfast in 2012.
Oh.
So I went back in time for this one. This one, okay. All right, number four. This is the fourth one. We are America, second to none, and we own the finish line. Don't forget it.
I think this could be very, I would say, I'm going to say Trump.
I'm also going to say Trump, but...
Biden.
This is Joe Biden.
Oh,
this is Joe Biden.
How do they all know?
You know, it's the power of the crowd. All right. Okay. Here's another one. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in 1 minute. 1 minute. And is there a way we could do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see, it gets in the lungs and it does a tremendous number on the lungs.
Trump.
It's been Biden like 6 times in a row, so I guess Trump.
This is Donald Trump at a COVID-19 briefing in 2020. Yes, all right. And then here is the last one. I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's, like, incredible.
Oh, I think Trump.
I also think Trump.
This is Donald Trump from a 2016 campaign rally. I know, Sarah, your work is going to be about campaign rallies. But this is actually a good segue into your work. Your work, Jenna, focuses on violent rhetoric. Is the quote I just said, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible. Would that be considered violent rhetoric in your study?
So that's actually a really good question. I would probably end up categorizing it as violent, but I'd probably actually categorize that as implicit because I have this code. It's called hypothetical, and it's basically, it starts with if I were or if you were, and it explains like a violent action taking place. And this is because it kind of like subconsciously works through the audience's minds and portrays this kind of behavior as acceptable to the audience, which is why it is categorized as violent rhetoric.
Yeah, so that last quote was chosen on purpose because your work, Sarah, was about rallies and your work was about violent rhetoric. So I wanted something that combined it, but maybe outside of, you did the 2024 campaign, Sarah, and it was something from 2016. But let's get into how you tried exploring not just, and I know for Sarah's this should be qualified, not just Trump's rhetoric in Jenna's case, but the rhetoric of people who are at these campaigns. Mm-hmm. So Sarah, what was your process? This is a lot of content, right? Like maybe you want to explain the scope of what you did, because I think both of you looked at so many words. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, so for the scope, initially I would say that I wanted to look at not only just the rhetoric of Donald Trump, but also the rhetoric of his rally guest speakers to kind of get more of a overall perspective of the left-wing party, I mean the right-wing party. And I think that in my research, I basically looked at 22 rallies across like basically January of 2024, which is when that election cycle began, to November, which was actually the date of the election. And through that, I looked through all of the transcripts, sifted out every instance where a female politician was being discussed, and kind of went at it from there. But I would say that for my scope, although initially, as I said, I wanted to look at not just Donald Trump, but his guest speakers, I kind of like came to only focusing on Donald Trump and the end. And that was because like most of the statements after the sifting process and the filtering process, there wasn't many statements actually said by the guest speakers. Actually, like majority of it was Donald Trump. And even in my example statements that I put in my research paper, like I don't think there has been a single one that was said by a guest speaker. So I think like even though that was the aim of my study, I think like in the end, I guess it was more Trump specific.
Okay. And Jenna, how did you go about looking at the debates?
So I went about looking at the debates. I actually went through a lot of different methods on the way that I wanted to go through it. I started with watching the debates, but I realized that it was taking me like 3 hours or 4 hours to file through a single debate, and I had 7 to go through, so I realized it wasn't going to be sustainable. So what I ended up doing is I would get a transcript offline, I would go through it, highlight it for violent rhetoric, which actually took way longer than I thought it would, and then I inputted it all into like a giant master Google sheet, and then I had ChatGPT look through my instances of violent rhetoric, because while violent rhetoric does have a set definition, can I read it?
Please, yeah, explain to people what you did.
My definition of violent rhetoric, it came from Zaitsev 2018. It said that it was language that can be explicit in which a politician calls for individuals or groups to be locked up, beaten, killed, one's rights to be violated, or otherwise harmed. Yet many times it is implicit, drawing on metaphors, misinformation, and defamation to disparage and dehumanize targeted groups and individuals. It can involve creating threats or provoke unlawful action, but it must have a target. It keeps going, but I'll cut it off there.
Sure.
So the thing with that definition is while it is a set definition, you can look at a quote and say this falls into it, it's subjective, especially when it comes to like the implicit section, because you can call something defamation that's really just a critical fact, which is bound to happen during debates super easily. So I tried to get rid of some of this bias by running my quotes through ChatGPT. And what happened was I would feed it my definition, and then I would feed it all of my like my instances, and I would say, tell me what in here is violent rhetoric and tell me what isn't. But I was having a lot of problems, because what ended up happening was I ran the first debate through, and I probably had around 30, 40, maybe even 50 instances, and it came back to me, and it was like, you have one usable instance of violent rhetoric here. And I was genuinely really freaking out, because I was considering changing topics. I was considering like throwing my whole project away. And what actually had to happen was I just fed ChatGPT more information and kind of recoded it. But it was like a big like pivoting point in my project, where I was like, oh, this is going to be a problem. I need to make sure that I do this right.
And we'll come back to that, because I think another overlap between the two of your projects is the fact that you're both using AI in different ways as almost like checks for yourself to check your own bias as you explore this. But thank you for that definition of violent rhetoric, because I think we need to establish the definition that Sarah's operating with, because your work doesn't really have to do with violence technically. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be violent content in there, but you want to explain what you were exploring in terms of rhetorical strategies, because this seemed to be different.
Yeah, so I just searched up the definition of defamation, and it really actually does overline with like a definition that I used in my research, but with like a different title. And that's actually delegitimization. And that's basically what I focused on in my study as a whole. And actually, delegitimization is the lack of accountability that disregards the detrimental effects of Donald Trump's speech, which can damage the reputation and the credibility of the targeted individual. Basically, the same exact definition as defamation. And for me, I kind of used deductive codebooks that were already established by Tirado 2024. And basically what he did was he kind of focused on misogyny and hate speech. And there were maybe 8 or 11 codes within both misogyny and hate speech that I looked into. And those were my general codes. But I think kind of adding on to that, using like a deductive codebook, I do feel like it was very effective and helpful in the beginning, because I kind of had a process that I had to follow, and it wasn't like I had to come up with my own things on the spot. But I do feel like during the middle to end part of my research, I felt like it was really like limiting at the same time, because I felt like I couldn't do what I really wanted to do. And I felt like that kind of restrained like the overall generalizability and like how interesting my research was to me.
Okay. And it seems like the even if someone's listening, they're like, you know, how are they making hard judgments about what is violent or what is misogynistic? So it seems like both of you had, in your case, Sarah, you had a deductive like framework already from a already established social science practice. And in your case, Jenna, you were, while the codes were emerging, like you created the codes, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. You did try to use basically AI, like an LLM, to try to check yourself, like whether what you were seeing was actually violent rhetoric or if it was just something that was influenced by your preconceived notions of, I guess, how Trump speaks. This type of work is subjective in nature, so it's very hard to draw definitive conclusions. How did you try to deal with that subjectivity, and what conclusions were you able to reach about the language being used? Let's start with you, Jenna. Like, what conclusions were you able to reach about the language being used, and how did you try to limit subjectivity here?
So the conclusions I found about the language being used was actually that there was a lot less direct threats than I originally anticipated. Like, actual threats only made up, I believe it's about 3% of the violent rhetoric used.
Can you give me an example of a threat?
So a violent threat would be, there was one instance where he was talking about people coming in, and he said that I had the U.S. military take them down, or he has things about ISIS where he's like, we're going to knock the hell out of ISIS, which I would consider to be a threat.
Okay.
And then while violent threats did not make up a lot of the rhetoric, it was actually very heavily skewed towards defamation, which made up, defamation made up was the most used tactic by Trump by far, around like 20% almost. And the thing is, while it was more focused on defamation, as it is a debate, and he's trying to convince people to not not vote for the other person, it kind of connects to Sarah's delegitimization. It's hard. There's a lot of syllables going on.
So
it kind of connects to that because he's trying to kind of like delegitimize them as like a candidate and try to like almost make it seem like he's the only fittable choice. But however, by doing this, he's also spewing all kinds of violent rhetoric that can have very negative impact. Especially he's saying things about immigrants. He's saying things that have very racist undertones in attempt to like try and target specific politicians. And it has the other effect of not just making people not want to vote for this politician, but also creating notions about specific individuals.
Was there anything in these debates that particularly surprised you? Was there any quote or key piece of data where you're like, I wasn't expecting to see this?
Definitely. I kind of had an idea about this because I've seen the debates before, but something that shocks me every time I see it is there's an instance in one of the debates with Biden where he says, where they're talking about white supremacy, and he asked him to condemn white supremacy, and he asked him to condemn a specific group. They're called the Proud Boys.
Oh, you're saying Biden was directing
yes,
this to Trump.
Biden's okay. telling Trump, he's like, condemn the Proud Boys. And Trump, instead of saying something like condemning, he says, stand back and stand by, which is like, it's not really condemnation. And it had this large issue where the Proud Boys were actually seeing this and tweeting stuff like standing by, sir. And they were actually getting riled up and getting encouraged by Trump. And they saw it as like approval rather than like what it was supposed to be.
And this is where rhetoric is important, because if there's a vagueness in language or a that may not have been his intent, but if that's how it's being interpreted by the target audience, doesn't really matter what the intention was. If it's inarticulate communication. All right, thanks. So Sarah, same question to you. How did you try to limit subjectivity, and ultimately what did you find while looking through these rallies?
Okay, I'll start with the subjectivity question first. I also used AI to kind of make my work more reliable. I actually like did my manual coding process myself, and then after that, I gave all the definitions and all the statements into Claude AI. I actually had to buy Claude AI Premium for that, which cost me $20. But
okay. Anthropic's making some money on this one.
It was worth it, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I did, and Claude AI kind of reinforced my manual claims. And for the claims that Claude AI disagreed with, I kind of like re-looked at them and looked at the exact definitions and kind of reestablished them. So I think that process was very, very helpful in kind of making my research more reliable.
Okay, so there was an instance where maybe you coded something a particular way. You're like, oh, this is the category it fits under. The AI gave you feedback like, nah, maybe not necessarily, and you actually had to adjust.
Yeah, there was a couple instances that were like
okay.
that. But for my actual findings portion, this kind of like falls into one of the things that I expected in my research, but misogyny was actually way less dominant than hate speech. And it only came up about 64 out of 383 times of all the rhetoric instances that I analyzed. And that was honestly not super shocking, because the previous study that I kind of based my study off of also found that misogyny wasn't super prevalent. But I feel like something that my study brought to the table was that there's this concept called modern sexism, and it basically means that like people in the political realm right now, although they don't explicitly use like gender in like rhetoric, they more of like direct these negative statements towards women, and that's like what modern sexism is. And I think my study was really significant in kind of like establishing that and finding that in actual rhetoric. Because one of the things that I added into my research process actually after my methodology was developed was like doing a name count of all the times like the female politicians were referred to by their first name rather than their last name. And in first name references, that's generally considered way less formal, especially in political discourse. But something that I found was that Kamala Harris was actually referred to majority of the time by her first name reference. And this was actually like a pretty stark difference in statistics. Like, I think it was around only 13 times where she was referenced by her last name only. And that was mainly referring to the Biden-Harris administration, not actually the politician herself. And actually 77 times where she was referenced by her first name only. And that's a really big difference in statistics. But I think that kind of shows like the subtle misogyny that I was really trying to analyze, because like although that isn't like a misogynistic statement that would be categorized through my coding process, it's something that like has a stark difference that I like actually uncovered.
this would be, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. So this would be like if someone's referring to Kamala Harris, they're just at a rally, they're just referring to as her as Kamala.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, just in my mind, I'm thinking that Trump is referred to as Trump. Like, I don't hear, I don't refer to President Trump as Donald.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't. And I don't know that many, I mean, sometimes people say the Donald. I guess that's like a throwback because that was how people referred to him like in the 80s, but in the 90s. But so that form of delegitimization is just sort of like, we're not going to refer to you as your last, by your last name.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the same? I know Nikki Haley came up a lot in your work as well.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the same with Nikki Haley or was it Haley or was it Nikki? Like what did that happen at all or?
I actually did mention her here. I focused on Kamala Harris specifically because I think her name was probably one of the most prominent, especially like as the time progressed and the rally or the election date actually came closer. But yeah, it was pretty much the same for Nikki Haley. She was actually referred to a lot by Nikki, not only just by Donald Trump, but also by the guest speakers as well.
All right. Would you say those are the major findings, or is there anything else that it's important you think would be important for the audience to know about what you discovered during debates, Jenna, or what you discovered during these rallies, Sarah? Anything else we should know?
Something interesting that I noted, because a lot of authors were mentioning it in like previous studies, is the use of populism, which is essentially trying to turn a group of supporters against, I'm putting this in quotes, but the elites, which in Trump's case always means like the politicians in power, even though one could refer to him as the elites because he's a billionaire. But populism... Yeah, populism only made up 7.7% of the tactics that he used, which was very surprising to me, bless you, because of how emphasized it was within all of my previous, like all of the previous writing that's been done. Something that I found was this is often attributed to the fact that Trump wasn't really a politician as much before running for president. He was a businessman, a very wealthy businessman, but he kind of relates the country back to a business a lot, which I thought was really interesting because within his rhetoric, he's often like, the country needs to work as a business, and he kind of prioritizes profit a lot, which I thought was really interesting just to note within the research.
It's funny because I had to exclude one of the quotes for the game that was about real estate, and I was like, this is totally going to give it away that this is a Trump quote, because it was, I forget exactly what it was, but it was something along those lines. It's like, everyone's going to know this is a Donald Trump quote, so I had to find things that were a little bit more ambiguous. Okay, so that's a takeaway from that. Sarah, what do you think is, I don't know, you may have already established it, but what do you think is the most important takeaway from the work that you did?
Okay, so I think like the most important takeaways from my work were not from like the coding process itself or like the deductive code book, but the things that I implemented during my actual like coding process. And one of the things that I implemented was like kind of dividing the category of criticisms. So criticisms actually emerged as the most dominant type of hate speech, but then that was kind of like very vague for me because there's many different types of criticisms. So I decided to divide it into ad hominem criticisms, which are basically critiquing like the person's character, and also policy profession related criticisms, which would be obviously critiquing their like proposed policies or anything like that. And actually, policy profession related criticisms actually came up 83% of the time, which is pretty dominant, but also 56 references were ad hominem, which is 40% of the time. Sorry, I got the statistics messed up, but
that's okay.
59% policy or profession related and 40% ad hominem. And although 40% is less than obviously 59%, like it was still really, really significant because 40% of the time he's talking about something that's not even related to the discussion of politics. And an example of this would be when Donald Trump said to Donald Trump said to Kamala Harris, "People say be nice. Have you heard of her laugh? That is the laugh of a crazy person. That is the laugh of a lunatic." And that was honestly really surprising to me because he's critiquing such a minuscule part of her personality and her character, which is her laugh. And that basically like doesn't really have anything to do with any policies she's proposed. And that kind of plays into the topic of delegitimization because actually, it was found that delegitimization is likely to occur if the authority someone holds is seen to have been used inappropriately or disrespectfully, which is exactly demonstrated in that instance. So I think those, like, although I guess more like subtle forms of misogyny were present in the rallies, like also very explicit forms were also there as well.
This is, for the last few minutes, I'm going to take what the two of you have been talking about and pose a question to you. You're about to start voting. You're going to be eligible to vote next year. And you've both done these research projects. Is there anything that you would hope would change with the way that politicians across the aisles talk based on what you saw here? Either it's like a reduction in ad hominem attacks, if it's I know that one thing that annoys me as a voter is the level of vagueness from both political parties where, like, they're asked a question. You may have even seen this in the debates, Jenna, where you're asked a question, and instead of answering the question, it's this song and dance there's no evidence really provided for, like, what the person is trying to do. There's no focus on policy. I mean, I don't want to influence what you say here, but so I'm going to back off. But what frustrates you as someone who's an up-and-coming voter about the way that politicians talk, and what do you hope would change? So we'll start with Jenna.
Like you mentioned, I actually have a code called pivoting. It's used 66 times, and it explains basically how Trump does not answer the question. And there's a point, I believe it's in the last Biden debate, where he literally starts criticizing Biden's golfing abilities rather than his abilities as a president.
I recall, yes.
But something that I actually think is really important is to stop, like, demonizing specific groups in attempt to try and target the individual, because it has very extreme consequences. For example, I know this is more about rallies, but it kind of says about how much rhetorical influence Trump has. In a study observing his 2016 campaign rallies, they found that counties that held a Trump rally had a 226% increase in hate crimes compared to similar counties that did not host a rally, which kind of explains how his rhetoric has such extreme events. So moving forward in the future, I would definitely like to see politicians not using as much hate speech just because of the extreme consequences that it has, and to kind of focus more on, like, the actual issues rather than trying to defame their opponent.
Okay. The study that you just mentioned, because that's a big jump. Where is that coming from?
It's from Nakos et al. From 2020.
Okay. So that was, I guess, and that was after the 2016 rally. So it was, like,
yeah,
4 years after the fact. All right, Sarah, anything that you're looking for a change in with regard to political communication and rhetoric?
I would say, since my study's focus is really on women in politics, I think that in the future, not just Trump himself, but all politicians, they should, limit the usage of misogynistic rhetoric. And obviously that's not something that, like, just comes in a snap. It's, like, internalized in some people's minds, and it's kind of become the norm in politics, but that's really disappointing to see. And obviously that has a lot of very drastic and serious consequences in kind of causing a lot of female politicians to kind of, like, pivot away from their position, and also causing a lot of aspiring people to kind of dissociate with women being in politics. So I think that is something that we as a society can improve on. And obviously, it's going to take a lot of time. But I guess studies like this, where you really point out that these problems are occurring, is really crucial in that step.
All right. Thanks. Any final words you want to close with before we wrap this up?
Something interesting I found is that while perhaps our papers, as Trump isn't supposed to be president again, like, he's already hit his two-term limit, there's actually a lot of discussion going on right now about him serving a third term, which actually goes against the, I believe it's the 22nd Amendment, but they're considering putting in legislature saying that that if a president serves their terms non-consecutively, like Trump did, that there's a possibility they could serve a third term. And while it's not very likely to actually be passed, at least in Trump's presidency, I think it's really interesting to note how this can continue and kind of how much influence Trump has as a president.
Oh, okay.
I think that's a really significant point that you brought up, because, like, I think that his presidency is very, very controversial, but the fact that he's even trying to propose the fact that he can run for a third term, or kind of, like, implying that himself, is honestly really shocking, because obviously no president has ever done that except for the what's his name? FDR, I think.
There you go, history right there.
Yeah, but honestly, that's really shocking, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because then a lot of other studies would probably be published based on Donald Trump's rhetoric as well.
I think this is how we can kind of bring it back to language, because the third term idea, he has tweeted it, or he has used Truth Social to post about it. He has talked about it, and then it's usually written off as he's joking. Mm-hmm. And it's hard, I think, for some people to tell when he's joking. And the idea that it's like, when is it no longer a joke? And when is it actually done for real? And that's a hard question, I think, for the majority of the public to know the answer to until something is done. But that's that's kind of what we're all navigating right now. And it shows the importance of rhetoric, because whether it's on Meet the Press or if it's at a rally or if it's at a debate, the words that politicians use, there's never been an easier time in history to record them, either through video, through a transcript. Like, they're on record now. Like, it exists. So it's almost like you can weave those narratives and see where they go. I don't know, but it's language is a big deal. You got to think critically about it. And I appreciate the two of you thinking critically about it for your projects. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.